So what I'd like to talk about today is some recent, you may have noticed a lot of attention in the literature lately to this question of what happens when you have theories with Fayet Eliopoulos terms, Fi terms, that's the Fi, in supergravity. And can you couple theories that have Fi terms to supergravity? And there's been a lot of claims in the literature, and there's been a lot of papers, and I would just like to give an overview now of where everything sort of stands. This is work done in collaboration with Brooks Thomas, my postdoc who is sitting right there and who will be talking later this afternoon. And I just put a picture here of Arizona so you can remember what it was like 2 years ago when you went there. That's indeed what it looks like. The cacti are more protected now in Arizona than the people, as you may have heard. And indeed, if current trends continue, everybody will move out, and this is what downtown Tucson will be like in 20 years. But anyway, so I'd like to talk a little bit about the Fi term. So let me just remind you about the Fi term. So this was originally proposed by Fayet Eliopoulos in 1974. And really, in string theory, in any kind of supersymmetric theory, there are only two ways known to break the supersymmetry. There's the F term breaking and D term breaking. And the Fi term is at the heart of D term breaking. It's the thing that drives it. And the basic idea is that as long as a theory contains a U-1 gauge symmetry, you can also introduce a corresponding Fi term, which just looks like this. You take the gauge field, multiply it all by itself. It's a linear thing. And so for dimensional analysis, it's a parameter which has a mass dimension. And so this linear term by itself is the Fi term. And you can add this. And if you work it out in components, it's just the D term within the vector multiplet plus whatever auxiliary term. This is just a total derivative, so you don't have to worry about that. And this is the D term times this Fi parameter. And the point is, at the level of the action, the Fi term is invariant under supersymmetry transformations, and it's invariant under U1Fi. And therefore, it can be added. There's nothing that prevents it, and that's the whole idea. And since its introduction more than 30 years ago, as you see, the Fi term really has become one of the standard items in the whole toolbox that the model builder uses to build SUSY models and break their supersymmetries. And models built around Fi terms are just too numerous to list. This is part of the standard SUSY phenomenology game that people play. But all is not well, because Fi terms have some unusual properties. For example, they have very restrictive renormalization group flows. They almost never dominate in dynamical SUSY breaking, it turns out. And it turns out over 30 years that it's been found that coupling theories with Fi terms to supergravity is exceedingly difficult. And in fact, there's a whole literature on this topic which goes over 30 years. And even in spite of this rather complicated literature, the question of whether it's even consistent to couple theories with Fi terms to supergravity has remained largely unresolved. And this literature goes back, as I said, 30 years. It has a long, torturous history. Started with Friedman, who took the first steps towards embedding Fi terms in supergravity. And then there's a lot of work, Stella and West and Barbieri and a whole list of people here. And the basic idea is that it turns out that if you have Fi terms that are non-zero in your theory, then that ends up mixing the R symmetries in the theory with your gauge transformations. And that causes there to be all sorts of charge shifts for your fields. And that leads to rapid proton decay rates and problems with SU3 color groups and so forth. And these charge shifts lead to problems with Dirac quantization. I'll be discussing a lot of this in this talk in a few minutes, so this is just an overview. But all these sorts of problems lead to the sort of result, the upshot, that there are no consistent and phenomenologically viable SUGRA models with Fi terms that are known to exist, either in field theory or in string theory. Yes?
So this is not a mathematical
construction, phenomenologically. Yes, absolutely. Mathematically, globally, it's okay. Locally is the whole issue, right? I'll discuss what the obstructions are. You're going to see it all. The issues are that you can't do it in a consistent way, and I will show you what the problem is, okay? There can be phenomenological problems like this. There can be more theoretical issues as well having to do with global symmetries. I'll get to it. That too, yes, yes. Those are not what I'm going to be talking about here. Right. Exactly. Yes. Not any effective field theory language can I consider my Fi term to be a pure constant. Absolutely. In string theory, it's different. So this is not necessarily about string theory. This is about coupling theories of gravity with supersymmetric theories with Fi terms to SUGRA.
If you are going to say that it's not possible to do something about it,
why don't I show you what I'm going to say by saying, yes, I'm going to, you'll see I have the conclusions, yes. So that's been the question, whether or not, okay? I'm just setting up the question, and right now at this point in the talk, there is a question as to whether it's possible. And recently, and this is why there's been a lot of interest over the past year, there was a very important paper by Komargotsky and Seiberg, which showed that this construction, having supersymmetry with Fi terms, leads to supercurrents, which are not U1Fi gauge invariant. So the supercurrent itself breaks this symmetry, they claim, and this is certainly true in some contexts, and even worse, it is claimed by them, by Komargotsky and Seiberg in that paper, that in the presence of the full Sugra theory, the presence of Fi terms spawns additional global symmetries, thereby contradicting commonly held beliefs about the absence of additional global symmetries in supergravity. So that would be the theoretical conflict. So taken together, these results by Komargotsky and Seiberg would lead to speculation, or a proof even, that Fi terms may be completely ruled out in supergravity theories. And moreover, the fact that Fi terms would break gauge symmetries, then if you don't have supergravity, if you don't have Fi terms at high scales, the gauge symmetry itself protects you from generating such terms at lower scales, either perturbatively or non-perturbatively. And therefore, although Fi terms might arise in certain limited contexts, such as happens in string theory, where you have particle spectra that exhibit Fi charges with non-vanishing traces, their role in most of SUSY particle physics then would be seriously curtailed. So this is a rather big result. But if you think about it, some parts of it seem a little suspicious. For example, it's claimed that the supercurrents of theories with Fi terms do not respect Fi gauge symmetry. But that seems a little weird because the Fi terms in and of themselves preserve U1Fi gauge symmetries. Moreover, these results also break R symmetry, it turns out, and that also seems weird because Fi terms in and of themselves preserve R symmetries. So this suggests all of this, that there's still a lot of rather complex issues here that are involved in coupling theories with Fi terms to supergravity. And so what I want to do in this talk is just give an overview of this question and review the current status with some new results and hopefully try to disentangle some of the thorny knots and misconceptions that are along the way. And there's a paper that Brooks and I have on the archive, and it's rather long, but I hope it lays out all of the issues as well. So let me begin. I'll start by reviewing some basic pedagogical aspects about supersymmetry currents and other kinds of currents in SUSY theories and their multiplet structure. And then I'll talk about the strange issues that arise when you have an Fi contribution in addition. And then I'll talk about different kinds of supergravities and the compensators that realize them. And then I'll answer finally the question, well, can you or can you not couple theories with Fi terms to supergravity? So ask questions if you have any. And let me just say that in this talk, I'll be in four dimensions. I'm focusing on n equal 1 alone, no higher supersymmetries. And in particular, a theory can have many R symmetries, and I'm going to call R5 the particular R symmetry whose generator is part of the 4D n equal 1 SUSY algebra. Okay, so let me just remind you that in order to couple any globally supersymmetric theory to supergravity, or in other words, to make it local, we really have to couple the currents associated with the underlying SUSY algebra to the connection fields of the corresponding supergravity. That just means that the supercurrent, J mu alpha, which is associated with SUSY transformations, and the energy momentum tensor, which is associated with space-time translations, these two must couple respectively to the gravitino, psi mu alpha, and the graviton, J mu nu, in the gravity supermultiplet. That's how you couple it. So as a result, many of the issues that come into questions of how you couple a supersymmetric theory to supergravity can be studied by studying the behavior of the currents, and in particular the three currents that we're going to be interested in. There's J mu 5, the R5 current, the J mu alpha, the supercurrent for supersymmetry transformations, and T mu nu, the energy momentum tensor, which is of course also a current. And the fact that these different current, the fact that these different transformations, supersymmetry, space-time translations, R symmetries, are all part of the same underlying SUSY algebra, that means that the currents themselves that correspond to them can also be embedded in a real vector superfield. So this is called the supercurrent supermultiplet, and you could write it either in terms of a space-time index or using sigma matrices in terms of alpha alpha dot. But either way, in component form, you can expand it out. It's a vector multiplet, and it has this classic form. So there's a constant term C mu. Then there's a linear term in theta, and that's chi mu is that coefficient. And then there are higher components, theta, theta, theta bar. And the important other one here is theta bar. So the important ones we're going to focus on are C mu, chi mu, and T hat nu mu there. And the reason these are important is because these are where these currents are going to be embedded. In particular, J mu 5 is going to be embedded in C mu, the lowest component. J mu alpha, the spinner, the supercurrent, is going to be embedded in chi mu. And T mu nu, the stress energy tensor, is going to be embedded in T hat mu nu. So the question is, what is the relation between JMU5, JMU alpha, and T mu nu in terms of C, chi, and T hat? What is that connection? And the issue is a little bit complicated because the precise relation between these Noether currents and the corresponding components of the supercurrent superfield is actually non-trivial. Because you start in your Noether calculation with different transformations, either the R current transformations from R variations or the Suzy transformations or the energy momentum tensor coming from space-time translations, and you get your Noether result. But then you can add improvement terms to these currents. And I remind you, improvement terms are terms which do not change the divergences or charges associated with these currents. They don't change the physics, but they nevertheless can change the form, the algebraic forms of these currents. So what you do is you add improvement terms. That's the first possibility. That creates these improved currents, and that's what I'm really going to be calling JMU5, JMU, and JMU alpha, and T mu nu. These are the improved currents, but even those then have to be related somehow to the corresponding components C mu, chi mu, and T hat mu nu. And these relations depend on the anomaly structure or the conservation laws of the underlying theory. So there isn't even a universal relation between them. It depends on the properties of the theory. And these begin to form the different supercurrent supermultiplet. So what are these different anomaly structures or conservation laws? So let me just remind you, in that most theories of interest that we care about, supersymmetry and spacetime translation certainly are going to remain good symmetries. We're not going to do any hard breaking of those. So clearly the supercurrent is conserved and T mu nu is conserved. But there are other quantities or anomalies which describe whether other parts of the maximal superconformal symmetry are preserved. R5 symmetry, whether it's preserved or not, is governed by the divergence of JMU5. There's something called special supersymmetry, and whether this is conserved is governed by this, what's called the sigma trace of the supercurrent. It's like, for any spinner, this is like a Feynman slash where you would contract with gamma, only here it's the sigma. So this is the sigma slash, if you will. That determines whether the special Suzy is conserved. And then finally, whether conformal symmetry is conserved is actually the trace of T mu nu. So the question is, what certainly these properties hold for the currents, but whether or not these hold tell you about the other symmetries, whether they're existing in your theory or whether they're broken. And in particular, there are different possible cases that can emerge. And each different case gives you a different conservation law for the supercurrent superfield. For example, if all the anomalies vanish, if all three of those anomalies vanish, then you have the full superconformal symmetry, it's preserved, and then your supercurrent satisfies a superconformal case conservation equation, which looks like this. This is the Suzy covariant derivative. However, if all of these are non-zero, then you have all of these anomalies, then the superconformal symmetry is maximally broken. In that case, you have what's called the chiral case, in which case your conservation law looks like this, where instead of having zero on this side, you have the covariant derivative of what's called the chiral multiplet, which just looks like this in terms of any unrestricted multiplet. And likewise, there's a middle case. If you preserve your R5 symmetry, but break the other, the special Suzy and the conformal symmetry, this is sort of halfway between these two, then this is called the linear case. In this case, your conservation law is not zero on this side, but instead you have a linear multiplet, which is like the field strength multiplet. It looks like this in terms of unconstrained superfields. And then, given that there are these different cases, the embedding relations between your currents and the components of the multiplet are different. In the cases where R5 symmetry is preserved, namely the superconformal case and the linear case, in those cases, J mu is just chi. The spinner is the spinner, and T mu nu, the stress energy tensor, is related to the T hat component of the supercurrent in the supercurrent supermultiplet in this simple way. And in all cases, of course, the bottom components are direct. But in cases when R5 symmetry is not preserved, namely the chiral case, in that case, J mu alpha is not just chi mu alpha, but an extra term. And likewise, T mu nu is also related similarly to the T hat mu nu, but there's again an extra term. So these are the embedding relations that you take after you've improved your currents. You have to have the proper embedding relations. So let me give you an example. Let's start with pure U1 gauge theory without an FI term. In that case, it's the standard theory. Here's just pure U1 gauge, pure U1, and there it is. No matter, nothing else extra. This is the theory of a photon, a gaugino, and an auxiliary D term. And this theory, of course, is superconformal. There's nothing that breaks the superconformal symmetry. And it has standard equations of motion. This is part of Maxwell's equations and so forth. You can calculate the Noether currents, and you get sort of what you would expect. And here's the stress energy tensor. And as expected, all of these can be improved in such a way as to fill out the supermultiplet, which looks like this. And indeed, you can check by using the equations of motion that this is superconformal. It satisfies the conservation law. That's fine. The question is now, what happens when you add an additional Fi term? So here's your Fi contribution. It's just the theta bar component of 2xCV, or in other words, it's this extra term that we saw before. So notice, of course, this is linear in the fields, and so this C carries a mass dimension, and this mass dimension breaks conformal invariance, and so the new equations of motion are a little bit different. But without the Fi term, we saw that the supercurrent superfield was given by this. So the question now that we want to ask is, what extra contribution arises from adding an Fi term, this capital C here? Well, clearly it's got to be some sort of C-dependent contribution, and we expect it to be linear in the fields, not quadratic. So the question is, what is this? What is the Fi contribution to the supercurrent? Well, to answer this question, you can just calculate the Noether currents and see what extra contributions come from the Fi terms. And what you find is that, first of all, there's no extra contribution to JMU5, which makes sense. The Fi term does not break R5 symmetry, and indeed it doesn't give any contribution which would have a non-vanishing divergence. JMU alpha and TMU nu, the supercurrent and the stress energy, they do get extra terms, proportional to C, linear. Here's the gauge eno, this is the D term. But notice all of these expressions are gauge invariant. The gauge eno is certainly gauge invariant, and so is the D term. In other words, Fi terms do not break at U1 Fi gauge invariants either, as we know. Neither R5 symmetry or gauge symmetry are broken. So that's what we said. So these results are exactly as expected. The new and somewhat surprising thing that we found is that these terms alone do not have the correct Suzy transformation properties to fill out a supermultiplet. And this is true no matter what improvement terms you might try to add. You can prove algebraically that there's just no way, regardless of any improvement terms, that these things ever will fill out a supermultiplet. And the proof is in our paper. And so this forces towards a rather strange pair of alternative possibilities. Either the Fi supercurrent contribution does not exist, this C alpha alpha dot must vanish, in which case J alpha alpha dot could only depend on the Fi parameter through the equations of motion. That's one possibility. The other logical possibility is that additional contributions from some other source must be required somehow whenever an Fi term is present in order to ensure that J alpha alpha dot contains the correct transformation properties. So it's either one or the other. And what we'll show is that, in fact, both of these possibilities are realized, and which occurs in which situation depends on the theory under study, and in particular, it depends on whether R5 symmetry is preserved or not. So you might wonder why there could possibly be two different resolutions to this puzzle. And the answer is that although we've been talking about coupling theories with Fi terms to what we're calling supergravity, as if there was only one supergravity to which you can couple, really that's not true. Even in four dimensions, there are multiple distinct n equal one supergravities. They all share the same on-shell structure. In other words, they have the graviton and gravitino fields, but they differ significantly in their off-shell components. Some of them have anti-symmetric tensor fields. Some of them have scalar fields. And there are different ways of completing the multiplet to form the supergravity multiplet. And it turns out that we can couple to some of these supergravities only by breaking R5 symmetry or U1 Fi gauge symmetry. So which supergravity are we trying to couple to? Normally, you don't have to worry too much when you're thinking about supersymmetric field theories, which supergravity you're talking about. But the point is that in the presence of an Fi term, this distinction becomes acute. And this is the reason why I think there's been a lot of confusion maybe in the literature from us, from other people, from a lot of the papers that are making various claims. And it's because there are different supergravities, and in the presence of an Fi term, which one you couple to makes a world of difference. So this, I think, is perhaps one of the important issues that people need to realize. The question is, which supergravity are you coupling to? And in fact, yes. It'll depend on whether you're going to break R symmetries in your low energy effective theory, because that would determine which supergravity you really have, I would think. Other than that, I'm not really sure. I think it has to depend on, ultimately, you look at your low energy theory, you ask whether you've preserved R symmetries or broken them in there, and that would determine which one you must have. That's a backhanded way of knowing. I don't know any way of constructing it to be one or the other. Maybe Joe. No. Yeah, right. But the question is, again, when you're breaking things, are you going to break it? Are you going to preserve your R symmetries or not? Are you breaking U1 Fi when you do, let's say, vacuum shifts? No, that depends on whether or not you're in. It depends on which supergravity you're in. Right, but you won't necessarily have an exact global symmetry if you're in the other supergravity. I'm coming to that.
Is the question whether you explicitly break the R symmetry or spontaneously break the R
Explicitly. Okay, so in fact, there are two four-dimensional n equal one supergravities which are considered minimal, meaning they have the fewest number of extra bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom that you can add to fill out the multiplet, and which I'll be focusing on. There are others, but these are the minimal ones. There's the one by Stelle and West and Ferrara and van Nieuwenhuys, and this is 1978. This is called the old minimal supergravity. I guess it was named that after the discovery of by Sonius and West 3 years later of what they then called the new minimal supergravity. New is a relative term, of course. But as we're going to see, coupling to the old minimal supergravity breaks R5 and U1FI, while coupling to the new minimal supergravity leaves those symmetries intact. But the basic point is that how do you do a coupling? You couple a theory, a globally supersymmetric theory, to supergravity by following the same basic recipe. There's always one way in the literature that you do these things. And the recipe sort of looks like this. So this actually comes from Brooks. Brooks was the one who found this slide, this cute recipe card. So basically what you do is you start with your theory, and maybe it has some broken symmetries, maybe R symmetry is broken, maybe conformal symmetry is broken, special Susie's may be broken. Either way, you take your theory and you add some compensator fields. And you do that in a very clever way is to promote that theory with some broken symmetries all the way up to full superconformal. Then, once you've made it superconformal, you couple it to superconformal Sugra. That's natural and easy to do, because everything is conserved, you don't have to worry about any anomalies at all. In other words, you make that compensated conformal, now superconformal theory local. And you do that in the standard way. Then the next step is to go back, break your symmetries back down to the way you started. In other words, you freeze your compensators, you set them to constant values, you make them non-dynamical anymore, you set them to fixed values, and that breaks the extra symmetries you had to add to this superconformal group to make it superconformal, and you get back the theory with the same symmetries that you started with, presumably. And in general, coupling to different supergravities requires two different kinds of compensator fields for the two different supergravities. If you want to couple to the old minimal Sugra, you need what are called chiral compensators. Whereas if you want to couple to the new minimal supergravity, you need both linear and chiral. But in either case, the general idea is that you introduce these compensator fields into your originally globally supersymmetric theory in such a way as to make your theory superconformal. That's step one. You promote it to a superconformal theory. You then couple it to a conformal supergravity, and then you break your symmetries back down by freezing the compensators. So when is a theory superconformal? Let me just remind you quickly that a theory can be specified in terms of a Kähler potential K and a superpotential W. And all you need to do is look at the Weyl scaling weights W and the R charges of your different fields, and if they come in such a way as to produce a Kähler potential with this Weyl weight and that R charge, and the W, the superpotential, has that Weyl weight and that R charge, if you've done that and you've put in your compensators so as to balance everything to make that happen, you have achieved those conditions. I don't want to drag you through the whole process here, but the basic idea is that, for example, chiral compensators for the old minimal supergravity. You have some fields that are chiral, sigma, sigma bar. They have some charges. You use them to soak up the charges of your fundamental fields, and you do this in such a way as to make a superpotential that may become superconformal. Likewise, you do a similar thing for the Kähler potential. You take it, you decompose it in a certain way, and you turn it into a new form that looks like this. Sigma, sigma, and then the old Kähler potential is sort of in the exponent. You do something like this, and no matter what your old Kähler potential was, this new one that you follow this recipe for is guaranteed to be superconformal. And then you have your superconformal theory. And the final step is to freeze those compensators, take those sigma fields and set them back to constant values. This breaks your Weyl and your R5 invariants. Even if your original theory had them somehow, this step will break them because these fields are charged under Weyl symmetry and R5 symmetry. And then when you're back, everything comes back. It's again, everything comes back to what you had before, and you recover your original Lagrangian, more or less. So when you want to calculate a current now, how do you do this? Well, as usual, currents are calculated from the standard Noether method, but what you have to do is do it in the full unfrozen theory, including the compensators. Then after you calculate your currents, you freeze the compensators. This is the important point. And since freezing the compensators breaks the R5 symmetry, this is why the supercurrent superfield conservation has to look like this in the chiral case. And so therefore, when you're calculating your supercurrent, there are two contributions that are going to come in. One are the contributions that you had from the fields that you already had in your original theory. That's fine. But the new thing is that you also have your compensators, and so they can give extra contributions to the supercurrent that you wouldn't have had before, which come in now that you wouldn't have had in the flat space limit originally. And when you do that, what you find is that in this case, the original terms, the supercurrent and the TMU nu, do not get any contributions that are extra for an FI term, but the JMU 5 does get an extra contribution. These contributions come from varying the conformal compensators, the chiral fields, but when you take the limit to go back to flat space, there's an extra term that survives. So this is the new contribution that comes for JMU 5 from the conformal compensators. And the old terms we had from the FI terms looked like this, and together now they do fill out a supermultiplet. So indeed, you do have an FI contribution here, but the extra pieces are not from the original theory. They're coming from the conformal compensators. The conformal compensators restore the SUSY multiplet structure. To get something happening like this, where compensators give a non-vanishing contribution in, is actually a fairly rare phenomenon. It happens somewhat, but not all the time. In general, your result for the uncompensated theory that you started with will be different after you go through this whole promote it with compensators, calculate it, and then freeze the compensators again. This will differ sometimes. It only differs when this extra term here is non-zero. But this typically cancels. In fact, the sort of situation that where it doesn't cancel, where this becomes an especially acute question, is when you have an FI term. When you have an FI term and the Kähler potential gets a 2 CV like this, then this is not equal to this, and in such theories, then you have a difference between the supercurrents. So that's what happens when you have an FI term. It's rather unusual to see something like that. So it's in the presence of a non-zero FI term that the contributions from chiral compensators are precisely what you need, and they're non-zero, they come in order to augment the individual near the currents and restore the supermultiplet structure. However, this result is not FI gauge invariant, and it breaks the R5 symmetry. And you can ask, why does it break R5 symmetry? Well, now we understand why. Because imagine your original theory again. You have some U1 gauge group, and it has a non-zero FI term, so there's your Kähler potential. So let's separate out everything else, plus the FI term is here. Well then, if you look at what your Kähler potential, your new conformally compensated Kähler potential looked like, remember it was sigma sigma bar and then exponential of the Kähler term, well, this part is gauge invariant under UNFI, but this is not. This is my extra FI term, and it's not gauge invariant because I have a shift, and this induces a Kähler transformation. And therefore, in order to have my whole theory, my conformal theory, be U1FI gauge invariant, that means that my sigma fields, my conformal compensators, are therefore forced to carry certain charges under U1FI as well. So the only way I can do this is if my conformal compensators themselves carry U1FI charges. That does everything I need to do, but the problem then becomes that since I've done that, then when I freeze the chiral compensator fields back again, I've broken the U1FI gauge symmetry. And that's why this is forced to happen. This only happens when I have a non-zero FI term. Any general U1, that wouldn't happen. But when there's a non-zero FI term, this happens. So this explains why the resulting supercurrent multiplet fails to exhibit the U1 FI gauge invariance in the presence of a non-zero FI term. That also implies something else. Because my sigma field, my chiral compensator, now carries an FI charge, what that means is that when I used it to soak up the charges of my other fields, I've now made a slight shift proportional to C over M Planck squared in their charges. And what that means is that all the fields with non-zero R5 charge that happened before now acquire a little bit of gauge charge as well in the full Sugra theory. And what that means is that there's a whole new set of problems. These small charge shifts are inconsistent with Dirac quantization. This is what I talked about before. Anomaly cancellation becomes highly non-trivial. And then what I'm going to show you in a minute is that there are additional global symmetries as well that come on. And so all of these are now the consequences of having been forced to break my U1FI this way. And to see what's happening with the questions of extra global symmetries, let's consider a trivial little example here. Three fields with U1FI charges, plus 1, minus 1, and 0 in standard R5 assignments. So therefore, there's the canonical Kähler potential for the positive charge, the negative charge, and 0. Here's my FI term, and here's the most general renormalizable superpotential I can write down. So there it is. And the only term which breaks global vial invariance is the FI term. That's it. The superpotential is, of course, vial invariant. So there it is. And now I can ask, well, what happens when I promote this theory to superconformal and then break it again? Well, when I promote it, I now have a little bit of a shift in the charges. It's proportional to the FI term. This is the little bit of shifted charges. So the U1FI now has a different charge assignment than it did before. But I still have my old U1 charge assignment. It still led to an invariant theory. And so now I have a distinct two different U1FIs. One of them is the local one. It still carries the U1FI gauge boson associated with it. But this other one is still in the theory, and it's now the extra global symmetry. It's left behind because the FI term split these two into two U1FIs, and one of them is the global remnant that was left behind. So you can interpret it as a global version of the original U1FI symmetry, and that's the problem. Because this is now the superconformal theory, but after I freeze the compensators, it survives. It's still there. And therefore, the full supergravity theory continues to have an exact global symmetry, which survives the freezing process. And that's bad. Oh, that's still there, but that's associated with the other symmetry. So you still have a local gauge symmetry, but there's this remnant behind. Right? You can break that symmetry. Yeah, what you have is really a mixture. It's this U1A. Yeah, you have this that stays behind. But the point is, this is the global symmetry. Yeah, there's a linear combination U1A, right, yeah. One stays massless, the orthogonal one gets a Planck scale mass. Right, thanks. So in the end, you wind up with this extra global symmetry. And this, as you know, runs counter to the Folk theorem, which is a Folk theorem for gravity theories, but it's proven in string theory by these folks that there are no continuous global symmetries in supergravity. So we conclude that theories with non-zero FI terms cannot be consistently coupled to the old minimal supergravity. In other words, cannot be coupled using these sorts of chiral compensators. And this is really what Komargatsky and Seiberg were indeed claiming, and this is absolutely true. So there are some ways you might think to get out of this. This is a general phenomenon, by the way. Anytime you have your FI term, it induces a splitting, and that leads to an extra global symmetry. So there's no way out of this. But the things you might try to do to avoid then this is to break the U1FI gauge invariance by maybe adding a mass term. It turns out that works, but you've broken the symmetry in a different way, so that may not be interesting. More interesting is to realize that the use of chiral compensators, which is what we've been talking about, is designed to couple the theory to the old minimal sugra. But we could instead consider coupling to the new minimal sugra. And unlike the case of coupling to the old minimal sugra, this is guaranteed to preserve R5 and U1FI symmetries. However, this means that we have to use linear as well as chiral compensators. So the compensator structure, the conformal compensator fields that we have to add, are much more complicated now. And basically, we have to add not only our old chiral compensators, but some linear ones as well. I don't want to drag you through the formalism, but the basic point is that when you do this, you find that, again, you calculate your currents, you have your contribution from the original fields in your original theory, but then you have the contribution again from the new conformal fields, the compensator fields as well, but now the structure of the theory is different, and when you take the flat space limit, there are no extra contributions that survive. And therefore, you find that the supercurrent superfield is the same as in the original theory, and indeed in this case, there is no FI supercurrent contribution, none at all. So this is the opposite case. And this is just in one case, but we could actually go further. And in our paper, Brooks and I were able to prove that you actually must have this result, no FI explicit term in the supercurrent supermultiplet, in any theory or formalism in which R5 invariance is preserved. And we just had a proof, and it's really very simple. But the basic idea is you can write down all possible things with undependent coefficients that possibly you could depend on, and then you use symmetry structures to prove that it can't be all those terms. And so in the end, you find that there's no FI contribution to the supercurrent in any R5 symmetric theory. Finally, you could ask about whether you get extra global symmetries. And you play the same theory, for example, same theory as you had before, but now you conformally compensate it in the way that you would do to couple it to new minimal sugra. And you again find various symmetries, but after you do the freezing, you find that you only get back the original symmetries that you had before. In particular, all the continuous symmetries that remain in this case are now local. There are no global symmetries. And so this is okay. So let me conclude then with the main points are that a unique FI contribution to the supercurrent does not exist. The three pieces that come out do not form a supermultiplet at all. That is already an interesting fact. And in particular, the near the contributions to these currents, the JMU5, JMU-alpha, and TMU-nu that arise due to the presence of a non-zero phi term in a Suzy theory do not in and of themselves form a multiplet. So there are two cases. For theories with broken R5 symmetry, you can construct an additional Fi contribution to JA to make this form a multiplet, but those are the additional contributions that have to come from some other fields, in particular conformal compensators. For theories where R5 invariance is preserved, on the other hand, the additional Fi contribution must vanish. In other words, C has to be zero, and therefore J alpha alpha dot, the full supercurrent supermultiplet, only depends on C through the equations of motion. Moreover, when you couple a theory to the old minimal sugra, as I've shown you, a non-zero Fi term results in the presence of an exact global symmetry. Moreover, it has a gauged R symmetry. I didn't really talk too much about that, but the gaugino and the gravitinos are charged, and therefore all these results are highly problematic for Fi terms. But when you're coupling an R5 invariant theory to the new minimal sugra, the symmetry content of the full sugra theory is the same as it was before, except things are local, and there are no final global symmetries. Yeah. It will have a property, namely that there will be an exact global symmetry. Now, if you are happy with that, that's fine. This shouldn't happen because perturbative string theories don't give rise to these things. So what I'm saying is this won't happen in string theory, but the point is you can't have it. If you believe the Folk theorem that says that there are no global continuous symmetries in gravity theories, Right. But I'm just saying, if you accept that Folk theorem, then this becomes a proof that you cannot have Fi terms, theories with Fi terms coupled to the old minimal sugra. That is the content of, I'm not saying this, this was the content of the Karmargodsky-Seiberg paper. They are the ones, as far as I know, who connected first the idea of having Fi terms and showing that that leads to the additional global symmetries. I think that was them first. But that's the point. If you are happy with that, that's fine. Then there's not an obstruction. But if you believe that those things should not exist, then this is an obstruction. So then my final slide, just to summarize, if you wish to couple then your theory with an Fi term to old minimal sugra, then fundamental Fi terms would be ruled out. However, if you wish to couple your theory to new minimal sugra, then Fi terms may be okay, but this can only be done for theories which have unbroken R5 symmetries, and then there are lots of non-trivial issues with anomaly cancellation and maintaining that R5 invariance that you need, but now maintaining it at the quantum level, and so forth. So still, this is a very problematic thing, but there's no necessary proof that it can't happen. And then finally, let me just say that effective Fi terms, as we were talking about at the beginning, that arise in conjunction with field VEVs that break UNFI, those are perfectly consistent, because we're talking about the lower effective field theory, not the ultimate theory that connects directly at the Planck scale to sugra theories. And so I think it's fair to say that the status of Fi terms, which had a rather torturous history already, still may be somewhat torturous in the future as well. So that's it. Thank you very much. Comment, yeah.
Just a question on your last point.
Yeah.
That does suggest that there might be some kind of bias if you're really moving in string theory, that if you have a U1 with field dependent Fi term, you can bound the mass of the field dependent Fi term.
You'd have to be able to. That's right. I don't think there is, but you know, that would be very interesting to do, because indeed you have to have a bound like that, because otherwise you could recast it in this way and then rule it out. So there would be a bound. Yes, that's nice. Shanda. Yes, on Friday.
In Bagger and West, for example.
In what?
No, in Bagger and West.
Oh, Bagger and West, yes. So, West and Bagger.
You pointed out that you can always write the gravity in terms of the constant G, which is K, the scalar potential.
Right. Right.
This object is scalar invariant, and therefore invariant under any Fi term, because the transformation of Fi term is just a scalar transform.
That's right.
So this is completely invariant.
That's right.
And the problem is that if you break up the...
What you're saying is that I can always use compensators or something to do the promoting, and so that's correct.
The function G.
That's right.
If you write in terms of the function G, there is absolutely no problem. And
that's right.
Need for
Well, no, your W has to have certain properties in order to.
W has to transfer.
Right, but there's going to be a global symmetry associated with that. In order to make that happen, we can talk privately, but as we did. But the point is that there's no obstruction to doing this process, but you will have a global symmetry if you're doing it this way. With the chiral compensators, one way. You can do it this way and avoid that. That's what I'm saying.
Right, maybe this is what I'm saying because of the second
way. That's right. That's right. Yeah. This way, you do not have to have any global symmetries that come out. But this way, there will. Yeah. I guess I'm both the host and the speaker, so let us end. All right, who's the next speaker? Who's the next speaker?